Tonight on Arena, Alton Pringle and Emmanuel Okoye tell us about their play Boyfriends. And in TV, we look at Disney's Under the Bridge and America's Sweethearts from Netflix. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can watch us on the live stream, rte.ie/arena. Lemon Soap Productions is a collective of young artists and makers focusing on stories of depth, imagination and character. That's how they describe themselves. Their latest production, called Boyfriends, is written by and stars Alton Pringle alongside Emmanuel Okoye. It follows a three-month affair, although I'm inclined to call it a relationship, between two anonymous men. It charts the ups and downs and roundabouts of a modern, and here's what you're calling it, situationship. Yeah. Boyfriends asks the age-old question, what is romance anyway? Delighted that Alton Pringle and Emmanuel Okoye join me in studio this evening.
Thank you for having us.
I have to start with that. What is romance anyway? I feel like throwing it straight at you, Alton.
Yeah, I think you're asking the wrong person.
The genesis of Lemon Soap Productions, maybe the company first of all, and where this project fits into it all.
Yeah, so the company came about, we were all in Trinity together. We all worked in DU Players, was our home for a time in Trinity. And we came out of it and we thought, well, we want to keep doing this. And maybe the most viable path to creating work is making your own company and getting it out there no matter how you do it. So we came together to do that. It's named after the bar of lemon soap, which I think Leopold Bloom has in Ulysses.
Indeed, yes, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He smells the soap throughout the day. So that's where the name came from. And this is our sixth project now. It's a real evolution for us as a company. We've done radio dramas, audio series. We've done two wonderful shows, the new theatre, and now this is our evolution of the company to a fully funded piece of work. So it's very exciting.
And the boyfriend story that you're telling, as I say, affair, situationship, relationship, whatever you want to call it, it's about this connection that happens and grows and falls apart and grows. And who knows what happens at the end? You give us so many endings, we don't know.
A lot of possibilities. Yeah,
there are loads of possibilities at the end of the piece. What was the starting? Because you never name the two people. They're simply referred to as A and B in the script. And I don't even think they're referred to by any name at any point along the way.
Yeah, there's only one name in the entire script. Or the dog's named as well.
Marshmallow.
My character's a dog, Marshmallow.
Most important character.
Yeah, pivotal character. The genesis came from, I was thinking about modern romance and what does modern love look like. And it seems to me we exist in this realm of everyone's afraid of commitment, maybe. So there's an awful lot of possibility all the time to these relationships, or situationships is the new lingo. So there's never really a conversation that seems to happen. It either just fizzles out or it comes to a head. And I thought, I've never seen that on stage before. So I was really interested in seeing with Boyfriends, can you have an entire show where they never really speak about what their romance is? It's all possibility all the time until it all comes to a head at the end.
And I mean, when you read something written by a gay man like yourself, the presumption is, oh, is this some part of a story that you experienced? Are there elements of you within it?
I think there's definitely elements of me, I think, because I'm playing one of the parts as well. I was really interested in imbuing certain characteristics, although I don't own a dog.
yes, because you're the character that you're playing, I had to check that with you beforehand. B is the character who owns the dog.
He has a wonderful decrepit pug dog in the piece. There's certain elements of me in it, but I think it is more of a universal story, but it is quite specific, I think, to the gay experience in the play. But I think, unfortunately, I think situationships are a big thing across the sexuality spectrum.
At what point did you come on board, Emmanuel?
In this version, I auditioned like everyone else. I think it was like November, December. My good friends at Lemon Soap, because I was also in Trinity with them, asked me to come in and audition, which I honestly love, because it feels like now I've like earned it, you know. Which is such, like, I feel like...
What makes you think you hadn't earned it previous to this?
No, as in, like, I feel like if you get a job without having done anything...
You've earned the part.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Because I feel like imposter syndrome is a big thing. I'm sure with everybody, but, like, with me a lot of the time. So it felt good to...
Despite your starting role, let's be honest, in The Dry, you know, you've quite a big part in The Dry, and you had a fairly substantial part in one of the episodes of Conversations with Friends, you know. So surprised to hear you talking about imposter syndrome.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know.
That's He's the star. Thing. That's what I keep saying. Ha! I'm just Shut clutching up, at the dust as he flies by.
Okay, yeah. Okay. Next question.
But when you read the script, was there something within the A? I mean, did you have a preference of character? Or did you know that you were looking at the possibility of you playing A from the outset?
Actually, I didn't. I mean, I read the script and I had to ask Alton, like, who was playing who. Hmm. I just love that they both have dark and light sides to them. You know, I feel like it can be very easy a lot of the time to read a script where your character is very one-dimensional or very clearly black, good or bad, quote-unquote, yeah. For, you know, this is radio.
Yeah. Don't worry, they can see you on the live stream.
Oh, cool. So yeah, it was just really nice and refreshing to read something where it felt like the writer wasn't blaming one or the other character. And it was really getting into why this relationship, and because I would agree with you, I think it's a relationship.
Yeah.
Why it doesn't work.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah. And then you're already nodding no to relationship. Maybe this is where the two characters
have
differences of opinion.
Well, I just think that idea of a situationship of they never talk about it. I wonder what would happen with these two men if they ever actually spoke about it, if they were ever able to say, this is how I feel and what I'm thinking about, what could have happened between them. Maybe you might see a bit of that possibility at the end of the play. But that's what makes it a situationship for me, is the fact they never actually talk about it. An interesting proposition to write a whole play where they never really
get get down to the nitty gritty in some ways. Let's listen to a clip from quite early on, and to be honest, in many ways they don't really get much deeper than that initial connection that they make, which is a very physical and just a pure animal attraction to each other. But sometimes you wonder, are they going to get in underneath that and get somewhere and move further on with it? So obviously this is the two of you as A and B, respectively. A clip from Boyfriends.
This is nice. Do you come here often?
This is where I bring all my annoying dates.
Oh, if I had any self-worth, I would be offended by that.
You're the weirdest man I've ever met.
In a hot, mysterious way.
Sure.
I was surprised when you text. Had to throw out the voodoo doll of you I was making.
Oh, no, keep it. I love pain play.
Aye, aye, aye.
Oh, you speak Spanish?
Death to all colonizers.
You were playing on my mind.
In a hot, mysterious way.
In a two monkeys making mischief kind of way.
What's your favorite film?
Am I boring you?
No, but your response is deeply important to me.
A Pride and Prejudice.
What the hell?
What?
That lady was like 100% a slave owner.
Jane Austen. She moron.
No, she wrote those books and she profited off the slave trade. There's no evidence that I know of yet, but it is out there. It has to be.
You're insane.
Well, I think it's profoundly sick to be sane in the world we live in.
Are you quoting Sinead O'Connor at me?
No.
There we go. That is Emmanuel Okoye and Alton Pringle. Couldn't think of your second name for a minute, Alton. Sorry. Alton Pringle in a scene there from Boyfriends. It's the play that they're doing with Lemon Soap Productions as part of Pride Week. However, and this happens throughout the play for both A and B, I think, in the midst of all of that, Alton, your character says, oh, you know, if I had any self-worth, I'd get annoyed by that. So every so often, in the midst of all the joking and the surface skim, there is a little... There is a little hint that there's a lot of stuff going on in these two men's minds, in fact.
Yeah, it's something I was really fascinated by. Of like, yes, they never really speak about what they want to speak about, but can you glance at it and glimpse of it and really give way that there's huge territory to be explored with these two men? And doing it in the rehearsals the last 2.5 weeks, it has felt really rich and exciting to think about that. But there is multiple moments throughout the play where I think it explodes into thinking about this is one specific insecurity or anxiety or puzzle that this character is trying to work through. And that was quite interesting to me to think about.
Yeah, and particularly your character has, you know, some dark difficulties in his past that he's trying to deal with, while your character is dealing with the mother who really is not happy about the gayness of her son at all, in total denial. Yeah. Mind you, the fact that she does find some of your sex toys. might understand why she was just a little bit perturbed.
What do you mean, Sean?
Well, for anybody, I think for anybody's mother to find anything to do with their sex life, would possibly be embarrassing for both parties.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
I'd have cried too. If I was the mother, I think I would have cried as well. Yeah.
But yeah, it's just, I love just those moments, those like bits of their lives and make it them both feel so real, which is, I mean, I guess with a story this simple, you have to have characters that feel real because you can't really hide behind plot or, you know, frivolous events. Or
and time passes all the time. You know, we're kind of there and maybe we're there a couple of weeks later. So, and it's just the two of you on stage. There isn't a big suddenly let's change location and we establish a new location. Mm-hmm. It's all created by the words and the acting.
Yeah, yeah. Which I guess is, I think is essential if you're going to write a play about relationships. Because you can't get distracted by anything else. Relationships are between two people. And if you're going to really dig into that and why, especially modern relationships, don't sometimes work, you need to just focus on those two people and the relationship between them.
And you have a Nigerian or Irish-Nigerian ethnicity. Have you brought, has that, of course it's you playing it, so you yourself are obviously going to bring part of you to it, but do you think specifically your ethnicity has fed into it in any way, Emmanuel?
Oh yeah, yeah. I think, I mean, and credit to Alton as well for writing it. A lot of it to do with his parents, A's parents, feel very familiar, we'll say. no sex toys. But yeah, I think, and even just like little things.
What were those aspects that you thought that speaks very much to my own experience?
Anything from like the food that he cooks, like the jollof rice, to his parents being very hyper religious and that being, you know, a big reason why they don't accept his sexuality. To little things like in an early draft, we had a bit about A's parents or A's mom finding the sex toys while she was cleaning his room. And I was like, Nigerian parents, that would just not happen.
They wouldn't clean they're not going to clean your room.
So then we changed it. Yeah. And I love, you know, it's nice to have the writer involved in rehearsals also, because it doesn't always work, it very rarely works like that, because then you can make changes like that.
Can happen that respect. But writer and starring in, was it essential to have an outside eye? It's Joy Nesbitt, I think, who's directing, isn't it? It must have been essential to have an outside eye in that respect, Alton.
Somebody that can tell you when you're crap, because I think as an actor you finish it and you need somebody to look to you and go, what was that? And somebody that can kind of track that and track that journey and support you in that. That was really important,
but like in an encouraging way.
Of course, it's a wonderful, joyous room and very creatively challenging. But yeah, it was somebody that can kind of keep an eye on it and push the text as well and push me as a performer is what I really wanted. I didn't want to rest.
I mean, I found it interesting in the reading of it today that it comes to what we realise is kind of the possible end. And then you give us, I don't know how many there are. You start end number one and then ending number 457, ending number 3000. So you give us multitudinous ends. What was the idea there, Alton?
I think it was because I really wanted to think about a way that the form of this play could emulate what a situationship is for me, which is possibility. Earlier drafts of this was a bedroom drama, but I kind of felt like I think that could be fun and could be really exciting, but I want to see how could you push it. So I want to see if the form of the play could emulate possibility. So it changes quite a lot. There's influences of rom-com, sitcom, period drama throughout Beckett novel. And then at the end, it explodes into like 4,800,000 something different possibilities of what could have possibly happened with these two. But ultimately, I think it does settle down to this is what actually happens in our timeline, but there's all those different exciting ideas.
And it is interesting that Alton brings up the idea of the situation comedy there, bringing up that character of yours, the Max character in The Dry, who's the boyfriend of, I can't remember the character's name. Boyfriend of Ant, who's the son of the brother of the
Sheridan characters.
Yeah, so they're all in the house. They're all in the house together. That situation comedy aspect, one of the things that I love about The Dry is that kind of mix of, you're laughing one minute and then there's something quite serious in there the next. The same thing is
Nancy
happening
is
in this play. Yeah, Nancy Harris is
Dan. Oh my Pat. God. Because that's hard. It's a really tough line to walk. Like I've written a couple things, but it's so hard to find the balance between comedy and tragedy. And I think I most enjoy when there is both, you know?
And there is a touch of that in Alton's writing here as well. You know, as you said, it's not as if one of the characters is an absolute saint. Like they both could just get on with opening up to each other a bit more, couldn't they?
For sure. Yeah. I think it's that idea as well of like, I think life isn't one thing or the other, which I think Nancy Harris is all of her incredible work. She's a hero, understands that. And I was trying to emulate that in the play where just they are laughing women, and that's how their attraction to each other is a humorous one, as there isn't so much humor in life, but then they start really stabbing each other as the play goes on in horrible ways.
You have the run in Dublin, which is part of Pride Week, and then you're off up home to Donegal. How much are you looking forward to that? I believe the granny's going to be there, is she?
Granny's coming to Dublin. She's coming to Dublin next week. She might be listening now. She's coming to Dublin next week, but she's coming again when we go to Angrenon. So we're in Angrenon on the 11th, 12th and 13th of July then.
How important for you all to do stuff like this, to bring the work like this home to your home place? How important is that?
I mean, it's both important and terrifying. I think the idea of being in my underwear kissing Emmanuel in front of a home audience is interesting. But it's also, it's Donegal is home. I live there most of the time. I love it. I love it. And I want to make my life there. And I think to be able to practice my art there with the wonderful support of Angrenon Theatre, it feels like a real privilege, one I hope I can grasp at for a long time to come.
And have you been up to Donegal before, Emmanuel? Or is
I have actually. I've been to Letterkenny and Angrenon. We did, I did a play called Tartuffe with the Abbey.
Oh, of course.
Year.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And we did a week in Angrenon, so I'm delighted to be going.
You're going back home to Donegal.
Uh-huh.
Back home to Angrenon. Listen, great to see both of you, and thanks so much for coming into us this evening. That's Emmanuel Okoye and Alton. Again, Pringle has gone out of my head, and it's a name I know from Monaghan. I don't know why it's gone out of my head all the time. Boyfriends is the title of the play. It's at the Project Arts Centre in Dublin from the 26th of June through until the 6th of July during Pride Week 2024, and then up to Angrenon in Letterkenny, County Donegal, from the 11th through to the 13th of July. And you can find out full details on the company's website, which is lemonsoap.ie. Now, Sue, our TV reviews on this Wednesday evening. We're looking at Disney's latest thriller series, Under the Bridge, starring Lily Gladstone and Riley Keough. This is a true crime drama based on the novel of the same name by Rebecca Godfrey, set in 1990s Canada. Riley Keough plays the real-life Rebecca Godfrey, and Lily Gladstone plays Kem Bentland, a police officer called to investigate the disappearance of a 14-year-old girl. We're also looking forward to a new documentary series on Netflix, America's Sweethearts, Dallas Cowboys Cheerleaders. This reality docuseries stars the 2023 Dallas Cowboys cheerleading squad, takes us behind the glamour of the on-pitch performances, shows us how much mental, physical and emotional torture is necessary to make the cut on one of America's most iconic NFL teams. With me in studio this evening, Dave Hanratty and Jen Gannon, who are here to review both series for us. Let's start with Disney's latest offering, Lily Gladstone. Oscar nominated, of course, for her role in Killers of the Flower Moon. Here she's playing a Vancouver police officer trying to find a missing teenager. Interestingly, she's a totally fictional character here, Jen. Did I say Jen Gannon and Dave Hanratty? I did, are with me in studio. Jen, she's a totally fictional character, but this has its starting point, a book by the character played by Riley Keough, what's her name?
Rebecca Godfrey.
She wrote a book about this whole event.
She was from
that area, Victoria in Canada.
Is a very small place in British Columbia. And she was a writer in New York. She was this very cool 90s writer. You know, she had the hair in a bob and she had smoking cigarettes all the time with her Marc Jacobs saddlebag and her Chanel Noir nail varnish. But she was a brilliant writer. And this story just pulled her back into her life, her past, in that small town, because she was a disruptive teenager in her youth, and she had a troubled background. And when she read in the newspaper this story about this girl who had gone missing after a very violent, vicious assault in the town, she went back to investigate more herself and ended up writing this book, not just about the victim herself, but about the perpetrators of the crime, who were also young girls. So it was very much focused on female rage, which was, you know, Riot Girl had happened in the 90s, and it was very much a time of change for women in feminism and young women especially, and what are the roots of this. That's what she wanted to get at. But her angle was very, she never inserted herself in the story, which she could have.
Which is done in this.
And I think the reason why is Quinn Shepherd, who was the showrunner, she actually met Rebecca Godfrey. She got all her notes from her, and they this attachment grew. And she said
she
is part of the story because, you know, on the one hand, you have her, who is this journalist who experienced the kind of life that these young girls who were accused of the crime, they called them BICs. They're girls who live in care homes, and they call them BICs because they are disposable, like the lighters.
Like the BIC lighter.
That's the way society treats them. That's the way law enforcement treats them. So she was very sympathetic, almost too sympathetic in a way, to these girls that seemed to, you know, had this violent attack on this young 14-year-old girl.
Yeah, and we're not giving anything away about that, because that is
news.
That was all over the news.
Because it took in everything. It took in, you know, aspects of bullying, racism, you name it, that was embedded in that case. So you have her on the one side, and then you have the fictionalised character Cam on the other, played brilliantly by Lily Gladstone, who is there to kind of be the law enforcement, but also be the person that is saying, you know what, maybe these kids aren't so innocent, and what drives them.
And that is a great, that kind of sets up a debate for us. Yes, there's the coming home story, which is kind of one side of things, which is interesting, but it sets up that debate for us, really, you know, how much are these girls who perpetrated the crime? Clearly the victim here is the young girl, but how much has their background and has the attitude of society to them shaped who they are and who they've become? How guilty are they? How much sympathy should we have for them? It is an interesting dilemma that's set up.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is very powerful real life material. The case of 14-year-old Rena Virk, which, as Jen points out, became a national news story, eventually became an international news story. And there is very much that kind of nature versus nurture debate. And are you a product of your environment? Which is contrasted nicely and neatly with the Riley Keough character coming home. And it is that thing of, like, this is obviously a dramatization. It is not an 8-part documentary. So you need to take some liberties. And as noted, the Lily Gladstone character is completely made up for the show. But I was very impressed by the fact that they managed to find the balance in terms of screen time between, here's your two big stars on the poster, but also the young girls get arguably just as much screen time, really. You spend so much time with them, you see their life, and you see how they have been thrown away by society, and they will respond with violence, and they will respond with experimentation. You know, like, there are limits to these things. You know, like, we've all been kind of teenagers, we've all done things, and you have to try and find the world and make mistakes, but the level of kind of violence that this goes to, both physically and emotionally and mentally, is quite harrowing. Yeah. I this is a tough watch, I will say. Like, it's quite dark, and ultimately it's desperately sad as well. It's brilliantly put together, but it is, as you say, it is kind of confronting you with those questions. It's not just kind of throw it on the TV and walk away from it and get on your phone. You know, this is genuine harrowing subject matter based on a seriously traumatic event.
And as you mentioned there, the younger characters who were involved in the attack on the girl, etc., are quite beautifully drawn here. Particularly Josephine Bell plays the character
Joe. She's played by Chloe Guidry, she is this hard-faced, pencil-thin, eyebrowed.
She's kind of mean girl. You think she's mean girl?
Obsessed gangster level, and she puts up this brave front, but you know deep down, as you learn about her, she's had a very hard scrabble background and is a product of that home where nobody wants her, or, you know, she was herself a victim in her own home. So she's the leader of the gang.
One of her big friends here is a character called Dusty Pace, played by Ayanna Goodfellow. And here's a scene featuring the two of them and Riley Keough, who's approaching them to kind of say, look, I want to find out a little bit more about your lives and about and to tell your story in some way.
Comar Jacobs.
Oh, thank you.
Are you a pig?
Do I look like a cop?
Don't be an idiot. So you just said she's doing something for school.
I just said that so I can get in here.
You can get away with a lot more when people don't take you seriously.
I'm writing a book.
About what?
The Misunderstood Girls of Victoria.
I've been doing some research.
Why did you come here?
Because I had a friend who used to live here when I was a kid. Anyways, I'd love to talk to you guys if you're interested. I'm gonna leave my number. And you can call me if you want to.
Wait. You live in New York?
Of course, she's immediately cool because she lives in New York. And you can see the small town, I suppose, kind of looking up to this big writer who's come back. But this is a true crime drama. You know, I have lots of questions when we see true crime dramas. Like, they always come up in my head. Like, what about the victim's family here? What about, you know, how are they going to be treated? How do they feel about this story being told? It's a dramatization of it. How does Disney, or do they?
They explore strike it the balance here. We have 8 episodes to play with, and a lot of the time, I don't think, you know, elongating these kind of shows is necessary. But with this, it is. And then in episode 4, they go back to, you know, her family, Rena Virk's family's past, and how her, on her mother's side, her parents came to British Columbia, and they were like a minority within a minority group because they had converted from Hinduism to Jehovah Witnesses because they felt embraced and welcomed by the Jehovah Witness community. And it's all about the fact that on the one hand you have Rebecca Godfrey and it's her homecoming, but then you have someone like Rena Virk who never felt like this community was her home, and she was always seen as an outsider, always trying to fit in. And it's those scenes that are so heartbreaking where you see, you know, she's so happy to be surrounded by these girls who treat her, you know, basically like another as well. So they are her only friends, though. And I think with true crime, it's really important, you know, because it is a very maligned genre, I have to say, but great true crime, something like Gordon Byrne's Happy Like Murderers or something like Michelle McNamara's I'll Be Gone in the Dark. Mm-hmm. It always makes sure it's not about the lurid details. It's about pointing the finger back at you and back at society. And this is the kind of show, because it's based so closely to Rebecca Godfrey's own work, it's the kind of show that makes you think and makes you ruminate about what part society as a whole had to play with these girls being abandoned in the way they are, and racism being at such a high level amongst those young girls at the time.
Yeah, we should mention Rena Virk, played by Veritka Gupta.
Outstanding performance.
One of the great performances, as is the Josephine Bell character.
Across the board, the performances are amazing, especially from the young actors. I mean, like, in terms of the more kind of villainous aspects, you do see this kind of lack of empathy, and it is genuinely at times repulsive, which is, you know, I'm complimenting the actors as opposed to the real life situation, but it is that thing of, like, they have been hardened into adults at an early age, and you have to wonder if they have made the right calls, but their actions can be quite despicable as well.
Stars on this one from you, first of all, Dave?
It's 4. I think it's really, really strong. It's like, it is very, very dark. It is very, very tragic, and I kind of like that it didn't shirk away from that. You shouldn't shirk away from that because it is based on real life details, and I think when you're trying to juggle that kind of sensitivity, it's extremely difficult, but they got the balance right.
Jen?
4 out of 5. I think it's one of the shows of the year for me.
Show of the year so far.
Extremely difficult watch, but a very necessary watch. And I think I think parents of young kids maybe balk at it, but at the same time, I think there is something there like that needs to be seen.
All 8 episodes available on Disney, but you might be watching them all in one go. I don't think it's a binge watch. Take your time with it because it deserves that. Let's move on then to the new docuseries from Netflix. This is a preview. It's not available just yet. We've all been lucky enough to see it. Set in the real life cutthroat world of cheerleading, we discover what life is like for the cheerleaders as they try to make the Dallas Cowboys cheerleading squad and just how hard it is to stay there. I kind of found myself being pulled into this show in a way I didn't expect myself to be pulled into it, because you just become interested in the characters here. But with the greatest of respects to them all, given the way they are made up and they are dressed, at the end of the first episode I was going, I don't really know. There are 36 of them here. And I can kind of see 4 types or 5 types, but I don't know any of the individuals just yet.
They do kind of become more clear as the series goes on, and they become more individualized. But I do understand your feelings around it in that way, because we're talking about something like Under the Bridge there, which is completely different, and there's no archetypes in that show. Whereas in something like this, because it's reality TV, they almost have to push the stall out to make you understand the characters very quickly. So they kind of put them into archetypes. Now, I mean, to be honest, like, they are this kind of fantasy amalgamation of everything from Miss World to, you know, Charlie's Angels from the 70s to Playboy Bunnies to Hooters Girls. That's the way they are displayed as a package. But when you really get down to it, you know, I mean, it's sad that in 2024 nothing much has changed about that image of them, but I think they're trying to lift the lid on the fact that, you know, this troop of girls, they're not exactly seen as athletes, but they do these punishing, grinding dance routines, these performances that destroy the hips, backs, legs of, like, young girls in their 20s, and they're definitely not paid as much as they should be. Like, they keep their full-time jobs alongside this supposedly glamorous role. So it does kind of lift the lid in that respect about what they are, you know, enduring. But I think the Netflix crew are probably too embedded into the Dallas Cowboy conglomerate to really push it further.
Yeah.
than it should, and I think it could go. It dances around a lot of issues, like something like race, because there's a lot of girls that are trying out, and the ones that get cut are the women of colour, which seems like something that could push harder on
all American girls very much to the fore.
The image, you know,
Let's have a listen to a clip. There, we kind of get two sets to make a big division. We get the veterans who are, you know, 24 and 25.
You understand exactly where you are.
They mean that they're there for four or five
country,
years.
You know, they are related to all America, you know, we're going to war for sports.
Yeah, we also get the rookies who are trying out and hoping to get on the team for this year. But here are two, I think it's two veterans actually that we get here. A second year veteran called Klein and a fourth year veteran called McKenzie, who are talking about, you know, what's involved and how important it was to them to become one of these cheerleaders.
We've got girls that are incredible at hip hop. We've got ballerinas. We've got girls that are more powerful dancers. We've got girls that look more jazzy. They're more soft or more sultry. Everyone can have a place, but it's just a matter of if they have that unspoken it factor.
We're all veterans and we've all already earned that spot. But it's almost even harder for all of us because we know what we have to lose.
Pressure is a privilege. Like, you don't put yourself in this situation if you didn't earn to be here. So just think of it that way.
All right, ladies. I know we talked about like a lot tonight, but let's go into this year with the best attitude. Just make it the best year and focus on us. Nothing else matters.
Yeah. Woo! 1, 2, 3, DCC! Woo!
Pressure is a privilege, Dave. So the pressure is on you now. Take the privilege on board. There's so much that we don't get in this series. You know, I ended up really, you know, rooting for them all to get through to the team and being upset when some of them didn't get through to the team. What are the problems? What are we not seeing here?
Well, we're not seeing the emotional and mental toll. You're seeing a bit of that. I mean, like, it's kind of like you have this. This is a cult, you know, like this is, it's obviously a distinctly American phenomenon, the cheerleader thing in general. But the level of devotion involved to have to be part of this, as Jen mentions, like, they're not paid that much. And one of the bosses kind of says, you know, people are very cynical about the money here, and they should be cynical. But at the same time, these girls come here to make a difference. They come here to be part of this family, and the money comes separate. So it's like, cool, I'm sure that your landlord will understand that at the end of the month. There is one girl in particular who is like big into religion. You know, she makes the point that she's like, you know, I've got this big relationship with Jesus and it's God's plan, whatever happens from here. But she's as devoted to that as she is to this cause of cheerleading, and they all are as well. I found this to be, it is a fascinating subculture, and I found it to be a very fascinating but also kind of superficial look at it, because it isn't giving you the nitty gritty too much. It's feel good in a way, you know.
We're not doing stars on this because we're previewing, but one final question to you on this, Jen, which is, it starts, and I thought, oh, it's starting with this big church in Dallas and how God loves Dallas. And but this was a church about which there was the Church of the Vision, or the Vision Church.
Yes, that's a separate documentary on Netflix.
And that was done on Netflix. But they start with that. I was expecting, oh, right, we're going to get a link between the two. Mm. Do we?
No, we don't. No.
So what's going on?
That's basically the algorithm telling you, we'll add in a little bit about this cult to get you watching that documentary about the cult. So, you know, Netflix, they're always wondering about your eyeballs. They won't want to capitalize on them. For sure.
There you go. So you reckon it's pure algorithm that has them doing that at the beginning to get us in there?
Yeah, completely.
All right. Dave Hanratty and Jen Gannon speaking to us there about Under the Bridge, all 8 episodes of which are available on Disney right now, but we would suggest you watch them one at a time. And 7 episodes of America's Sweethearts, Dallas Cowboys Cheerleaders, will be available to stream on Netflix for tomorrow. By the way, if you don't put in Dallas Cowboys Cheerleaders, you'll get the film America's Sweethearts, which is a totally different film.
Forgotten Julia Roberts classic.
Yeah, exactly. So make sure you put in Dallas Cowboys Cheerleaders if you're searching on Netflix. Now, as you're probably aware, the Cork Midsummer Festival is currently running in venues all over the city of Cork. I think there might be some in the county as well. While we have been concentrating on music and theatre recently, there is also an exciting programme of visual art shows with a very participative edge involved here. Christine Leach has been to some of the shows first. She joins me now from our Cork studio. Well, there are unusual venues and there are unusual venues. The first show that you're going to talk with, Christine, certainly fits into unusual location. we're in a swimming pool.
Yeah, isn't this great?
Wormy togs or not wormy togs?
Well, it's funny because I told someone I was going down to see this show last night and it starts at 10:15. The doors open at 10 p.m. because this is a working swimming pool which still has people using it during the day. It's in the Gus Healy swimming pool, which is on the Douglas Road, just off the Douglas Road. And when I said last night I was going down to a show in a swimming pool, I was asked, was I wearing my togs? You don't have to wear your togs. But it is advised to wear light clothing because it gets very hot in here in this show. And obviously it is a swimming pool, so the air is full of chlorine. And you're basically sitting along the benches along the side where you would normally be if you were maybe a parent just watching a swimming lesson.
And being too warm watching the swimming lesson, even though you're just sitting there watching it. You're
absolutely
not doing anything at all, I presume.
Yeah. So it's advised to bring a bottle of water with you as well.
Bottle of water and make sure you have a t-shirt that you can get down to.
Exactly.
And possibly have your swimming togs in reserve just in case.
Well, we're not asked to jump in anyway.
So yeah, I was a bit worried when I saw the participatory edge here. I thought, are you going to be asked to get into the swimming pool if you go along? So the show is called, I should say, Kilter, Matter and Ghosts. So maybe if you start by describing it, I think how it opens would actually get us into the feel of what's involved here.
So the artist behind this is called Natasha Burke. She's an Irish-Dutch artist, and it probably tells you a lot that you might need to know about this, that she's from a visual art background, but she is also an experimental filmmaker. She's a performance artist with a dance background and also a clowning background. So what happens when you go in? The swimming pool area is completely dark. As I said, you're sitting along the edge, along the bench, and there's this loud, repetitive kind of beat, like a rhythm. And I thought it was some sort of water pump going. And I was like, what is this loud noise? And it's a loud noise going really, really fast. The pool is half covered by the blue plastic cover. And there's a spotlight. So you're hearing this noise and it's getting louder and louder and louder. And the room is very hot. And soon everyone is getting quite sweaty. And slowly this plastic swimming pool cover starts to roll back. And it reveals that there is a long, long plank going out into the centre of the pool, just floating there. And as it goes up, what you see at the deep end of the pool is an enormous washing machine, and the noise is actually the sound of the drum going around. Now this is a giant prop, and it gets louder and louder and louder. It starts to do that spin thing that washing machines do towards the end, looks like it's about to jump off into the edge of the pool, and then it stops, and there's a voiceover that says, "You have been born 3 weeks ahead of schedule. It's 1982, the year of the water Labrador." And slowly out of the washing machine comes this, first a bundle of washing, and then some hands, and then some feet, and slowly Natasha Burke emerges in this very clown-like, very physical performance. She comes out of the washing machine and starts to do a type of absurd ballet dance down the plank into the centre of the pool. So that's where we begin.
Right, okay. And the fact that you say it starts with that announcement that you have been born is a little bit ahead of time. We're starting with a birth. Are we going to make our way through some kind of tale, some kind of autobiographical tale here?
Yeah. So this show, I'm going to describe it as a 1 hour performance memoir set in a swimming pool. I think that might be the most succinct way to describe it.
And also, I don't think you'd be describing too many other shows about like that in years to come.
So it's autobiographical. Actually, the material that advertised the show, it describes it as a show about legacy, identity, transience and survival in an odd chlorinated urban womb. The origin of the show is that Natasha Burke injured herself during an aerial performance in 2012, I believe, quite a long time ago. She had to do a lot of recuperation swimming in swimming pools. That was part of what she did to get better. She was swimming on her back, and slowly the images for this show started to come to her. She started to think about putting on a show in a swimming pool in 2018, and between the jigs and the reels, she got here in 2014 to present this in the Gus Healy swimming pool. It looks at the pool as a site of kind of finding identity, finding your body, movement in water, but it also takes you through her own personal journey as a performer. It uses footage from her childhood talent shows. There's voice recordings of both of her parents, and it's a really poignant and very odd and oddly beautiful performance. Yeah,
and you've mentioned that she injured herself in an aerial performance. performance, but I think we still get some aerial dancing or aerial performance in this, as well as swimming and movement within the water. So she puts herself through the ringer, never mind the washing machine.
It's endlessly surprising, actually. In fact, this show, like when you think, oh goodness, what's happening now? Something new happens. So there are a variety of absurd costumes. She's moving around the pool, in and out of the different doors, and in and out of the changing rooms and everything. The audience stay put; you don't move as the audience. The lighting and the sound. She's playing various instruments, gongs, various different instruments, and also using these oversized props, like an enormous silver spoon. As she's singing, she's singing a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down, and then she straps this to her back, climbs back into the pool, and starts swimming with it. So there's all of these different things that occur, and in the end, it is a narrative tale, but it doesn't come together like something that you could say this is the full story.
Yeah.
You're aware that she trained as a ballet dancer. You're aware that she has this background in clowning and in aerial performance. And you're aware that she's dealt over the years with questions about her own identity. And there's a really poignant meditation at one point on the relationship between mothers and daughters and the nature of parenting. So, I mean, it's quite hard to describe, to be honest with you. And it's definitely a show that is more about feeling than trying to figure it out logically.
Yeah, and I think it's visually it's quite exciting. Big props and a kind of a that clowning aspect to Natasha Burke's presentation here has a kind of a Done Believables. I think you made a comparison to them in style.
Know, there's this, you know the way when the Done Believables do a show, it's very it involves the audience in the joke. So her style of clowning, she's frequently looking to see are you getting the joke, you know, or she's looking to see, you know, she's looking with an awareness of the fact that she's being absurd, you know, and she's sort of saying to you, isn't this ridiculous what
bit
I'm doing?
Nod,
you know?
A bit of a nod and a wink.
So the physical performance is very much like, look at me doing these ridiculous things. But of course, everything about clowning really in the end of the day is about pathos and about human connection and emotion. So it is absurd and it is a surreal show and it's full of visual and physical puns, but it's also just wordlessly poignant and also really engaging. I was utterly engaged for the full hour. There's no break in this. So they do say at the beginning, if you think you might need to leave because you might get too hot, you need to stay near the entrance so you can get out.
Yeah.
You know, and it's important to probably be aware of that.
It's sold out at the moment, but there is a waiting list and you're telling people, get your name down on the waiting list because it is well worth it.
Yeah, so people gather outside and you're all let in little groups as you go. So if someone hasn't turned up for their ticket, they'll definitely will be able to let you in and there is a waiting list, yeah. It's a very beautiful, very beautiful show and very strange, but really, really wonderful.
I should mention too that your full declaration of interest. You found out after the event that your brother Brian Leach made a monochord that she plays in the Curragh.
I know.
At the very end.
It was very funny. At the end of the show, I'm not giving too much away, but you know, there's a Curragh that appears in the swimming pool. But she's playing this beautiful instrument at the end of the show, and I was looking, think that looks like something my brother might have made. And afterwards, I discovered it was. So he made the monochord that's at the end. Yeah.
Next show that you went to is Tina Segal's This You. IIU, which is described as a dialogue with El Greco's painting The Adoration of the Shepherds, you know, I suppose real high Renaissance we're talking about in the case of that particular painting, the Adoration of the Shepherds and the Children and Their Guardians. What is the Tino Segal show?
Okay, so for people who aren't aware of Tino Segal's work, he was born in London. He's Berlin based. He's an artist of German and Indian descent, and he makes works that are all about performance. They are works that are made in the moment by interpreters. So he doesn't call the people who are involved in them performers. He calls them interpreters. They're interpreters of the work. They're not documented. There are no photographs. You are not allowed to take photos or use your phone when you're there. And it's all about being there in the physical presence of the, I was going to call them actors, but in a way, they're movement artists. So this particular show is in the Millennium Hall in City Hall in Cork, which is a very large, very tall atrium space. It's probably about the size of a basketball court, I think. And what we have here is groups of parents and babies performing these beautiful slow movements and gestures whilst making sounds. And so, it's in response to the El Greco painting.
Okay, so are the parents and babies people who have come along to be part of the show, or is it a set? Is it the same parents of babies who are performing every night?
So the show is cast, yes. So there is a list of performers, and again, because Cork is so tiny, I discovered I know one of the babies in the show when I went along to have a look. One of the local movement artists is Sarah Hernandez, and her 3-month-old daughter Samira is in the show. I think that's the youngest baby in the show. So there's a central cast who have performed this before. This was actually commissioned by the organisation that owns the original painting, which is a 16th century painting by El Greco, in which the baby Jesus is lit by this bright light and is surrounded by the adoring shepherds and held in the arms of the Virgin Mary. The work, so that painting, I should say, does not appear anywhere in the Cork iteration of the show. So that painting is not visible and it's not here. So it's kind of up to you to be aware of that as a background to the show. And initially I thought to myself, oh, I wonder why it hasn't been projected somewhere on the wall, because this is a large space, you could have done that. But in a way, you know, it's about just being present with the physical movement. So it's absolutely mesmerising. I've been in twice to see it. This is free to see, I should say. It's open during certain hours and you can pop in at any time. You don't need to book. The first time I went in, there were about 3 people there. Today I went in and there were 40 people in the room watching this. So the babies come and go with their parents. These are, I guess, actor babies who are involved in the show. The actors are making a series of noises. They're making a lot of rhythmic noises, which the babies are engaging with. And there's this interesting thing that happens. So the babies become, there's usually one or maybe 2 babies at a time in the show, or doing the movements with the parents. The babies become a focus because, of course, everyone looks to see the babies' reactions. But also the babies are the ones who are looking and focusing on the performers. Their movements and the sounds that they're making are really designed to entice the baby's interest. So they're making these rhythmic sounds. They're saying things like boom, 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 and they're doing kind of, at one point some of the interpreters are doing like a beatbox sort of sound. The babies get utterly engaged. Now, there was one baby who was not happy and had to leave because he just wasn't into it.
I suppose some babies will get upset by noise, might get upset one night but might get upset another night.
Yeah.
I guess it is the challenge of working with infants.
I suppose so. So it's on until the 21st from 2 to 7 p.m. and it's on in the 22nd and the 23rd from 12 to 5. So there are these slots. And I think I kind of counted overall maybe about 8 interpreters working. And at any one time, you might have 2 people or up to maybe 5 people. And they come and go from the space, as can the viewers. So you can walk into the space, you can sit on the floor, you can lean against the wall. It's very interactive. Tina Segal does these pieces where, in a way, sometimes when you walk in, you're not sure whether you're standing next to a performer or a viewer. You know, you're not really sure what's going on. This particular show really makes use of the fact that El Greco, if you know El Greco's paintings, have these very elongated bodies with the long hands. There's a painting in the National Gallery, people might know it, the St. Francis painting. So, you know, it's those kind of stark colours and elongated bodies. So the performers here are all making these elongated shapes. They're moving their fingers slowly. And they make these beautiful compositions with their bodies, essentially. And there's loads of moments of levity, too. Sometimes the babies are hilarious.
Can you explain the title, This You, I You?
Yeah, as far as I understand it, this is a type of mirroring, a reference to mirroring. And this is something that occurs in the show. So at one point, maybe one of the performers will put their hands out and move their fingers. And the baby reaches out, too, because babies mimic, you know. So it's this thing to do with mirroring this. So the you, I you. And at some points, the performers also voice those things. So they start singing. And there's a wonderful acoustics in that space, actually, in City Hall. So they start singing and it starts to become this sort of almost worshipping, spiritual kind of choir sound. It has to be seen to be experienced. It's something you can walk in and out of. At one point, there's a section, so it repeats probably every about half an hour. There are set series of movements they're making. Obviously, it's a little unpredictable with the babies, but the set series of movements that Tino Segal has set out and the sounds that they're making are the kind of cauldron that it's contained in, you know? Yeah.
This You, I You, the title of that show. And both shows, unfortunately, are sold out, but there is a waiting list for tickets. And
well,
I know
Tino Segal, you can go to at any time.
Oh, no, so you can go into it at any time.
No booking required. You can walk in at any time. time while it's on. Yeah.
Okay, this UIIU, and then the other show which has the waiting list, Kilter, yes. Matter and Ghosts. You can find out full details on corkmidsummer.com. And that is our lot for this Wednesday evening. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Research this evening was by Leah Murphy. Pather Carney was on sound, and tonight's programme was produced by Therese Kelly. I'll be off for a little while now. Kay Sheehy will be in the seat from tomorrow. I'll be back with you later in the summer. So till then, take good care of yourself. Hope to talk to you in a little while, before too long is my plan. John Creedon will be with you after the news.